Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week I am very excited to present to you our client, Tim Harsh. Tim is the CEO and co-founder of Owler, a business insights company based in San Mateo, California. He is a lifelong athlete, having played soccer, lacrosse, and rugby in his younger years and more recently competing in triathlons. He is also a type 1 diabetic, diagnosed at the relatively late age of 17. We've had the pleasure of working with Tim over the past year as a member of our Elite Performance Program. On this podcast, Tim talks about the tools he uses to manage his diabetes, including a low carbohydrate diet and a continuous glucose monitor. He also discusses the benefits he's found in working with the MBT team, including weight loss, strength gains, and improved sleep and stress management. He describes the dietary changes that have helped him the most over the last year and his best advice for others living with type 1 diabetes. Just before we get into this week's interview, I'm sure by now you're familiar with Dr. Josh Cherknet's four-quadrant model and you know exactly how best to win at Angry Birds. So I have a question for you. Last week, Daniel Cortez talked about how he recovered his health and performance by minimizing environmental mismatch. He also talked about the mescaline-containing psychedelic cactus, San Pedro. But what quadrant is that? Come on, think about it. What quadrant? I had the opportunity to talk to Josh about it, and he'd put psychedelics in quadrant 2, along with other evolutionarily familiar and disruptive therapeutics like fasting, lifting weights, and hot-cold exposure. Putting psychedelics in quadrant 2 would again explain the significantly greater benefit-to-risk ratio compared to quadrant 4 prescription psychopharmaceuticals. Now that we've got that cleared up, over to the interview with Tim Harsh. Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining me at the West Coast regional headquarters of Nourish Balance Thrive and also the International Recording Studio.
Absolutely, Chris. Great to be here.
We're currently stood under the awning of my VW Eurovan that is my makeshift office, since I figured out that I can do much deeper coding work whilst out of the house and away from the small children. That was Cal Newport's deep work. That's had a huge impact on my productivity as a coder.
Beautiful so, view too.
Yeah, it's great. It's good. I love Bonnie Doon. It's a little bit quiet, but maybe that's a good thing. I'm here with our elite performance client, Tim Harsh, and we've just got back from the beach. Tim, I think we're going to have to start calling you Eagle Eye Tim after you spotted my five-year-old daughter lost a ring on the beach. And I thought, there's no way that's ever coming back. And you spotted it right away. What the heck?
Good thing I had my contacts in today.
Oh, really? You wear contacts? I didn't know that. That's awesome. Well, I wanted to start by talking about your experience as a founder. Tim is a type 1 diabetic, and he's learned a ton about how to manage that condition. But we'll get into that a little bit later. Let's start by talking about Owler. What problem does Owler solve?
So Owler solves the problem of information on private businesses around the world and solves that problem via crowdsourcing. So crowdsourcing information so you know more about the businesses that you're either working with or working for and all the other companies in the industry and their competitors.
Okay. And why is it helpful to know something about another business?
Obviously, if you're investing in a company, it's important to know, you know, what's going on in that business. But also, if you're partnering with a company, you want to know how much can I trust them? How much can, you know, I rely on them? As well as potentially if you're selling into a company. Those are kind of our three big use cases.
Does anyone ever get pissed off? Do you ever get people saying, that's not right about my company. Can you take that down?
We do, especially in the earlier days, we did a lot. You know, these days, most people understand that it is a great place for them to make their company more well-known. Okay. And so they view it as somewhat of a marketing tool for their company, but we still occasionally get some complaints of, hey, that's our exact revenue number and they're all estimates, but how'd you get that? That's inside information.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How interesting. So the power of the wisdom of the crowd is the term I'm looking for there. And it's working for you in this particular space.
It is. It's been great. I'm sure you could go on there and find companies that you're like, I know for a fact that's not quite right. But you know, the beauty is the community input and people are generally pretty close on their estimates.
Okay. And how do you go about verifying what people tell you about a company?
So there's a combination of both manual verification. We have a data team that works on that. And then there's also the trust that we build up in users over time. So users come in and we'll see how closely they're voting to other users in the community. And based on that, we'll actually build up trust in you over time. So day one, you know, we don't know who Chris is, so we may not trust you that much, but 6 months in, if you've agreed with lots of others in the community, we'll have a lot more trust in every vote you make.
Okay, interesting. Have you ever tried to use supervised machine learning to do any of this stuff?
We actually haven't. It's a great idea. We should talk more about it.
It does seem doable though, doesn't it? Like if I can just find another company a bit like this one, well, can I say anything about their revenue?
Yeah.
Or at least the anomaly detection, right? Like if somebody just gave me some information about this company.
Yeah.
I think that's not right.
There are a lot of applications.
Yeah. Have you noticed how good the credit card fraud thing is now? It's like they just text you right away the moment somebody places a fraudulent act. I mean, it's that sort of thing, isn't it? Like somebody just sent me the revenue number for this company. There's no way. Like the algorithm says no. Could be interesting. If you've got a big enough data set, that is.
Right. Yeah, we should set that up.
Well, talk about life as a founder. What's it like? I hear, you know, obviously it's a world that I'm interested in. I've been spending a lot of time online, especially recently, watching videos from companies like Y Combinator. I've got some really good resources online. And Alison Lance is a personal trainer I met at Brian Walsh's Blood Chemistry Interpretation weekend seminar, which is still ongoing, by the way. And Lance came for dinner and he spent a while talking to me. And then afterwards, he sent me a link to Seth Godin's Startup School, which is a podcast series from 2011. And it was amazing. I absolutely loved it. So I've been thinking about founders a lot recently, and they even use these words like the startups are like the Olympics. And so you need to treat yourself like an athlete. You know, you're going to be working some long, hard hours and you're a cognitive athlete, right? You're using your brain, you're a knowledge worker, and you need to look after that. But yeah, I'm not really sure how much detail and depth they go into. But well, what's it like for you as a founder? Is it as crazy as some people would have you believe?
It's definitely, you know, a roller coaster of, you know, you're kind of one day you're conquering the world and, you know, at the tip top, and then the next day it's a house of cards and it's all going to fall apart. And, you know, that definitely takes a toll over time. I mean, Owler now has been around for 8 years. So, you know, a lot of movement in that time. And, you know, throughout all of that, trying to maintain good health, good sleep, good kind of fitness overall, that's definitely a challenge throughout all of that.
Is it your job to hide that emotion from your employees or colleagues or whatever you call them? You know, like you've got all this pressure that you shoulder, and then you don't really want everyone else to know that because it might be bad for morale. Is that a thing, or am I making that up?
No, I think that's definitely a thing. You kind of have to look into this vast uncertainty in front of you, and then, you know, turn around and kind of talk to the team and say, okay, here's definitively where we're going, and you know, have that certainty. And, you know, that's definitely a big challenge as well.
I've heard people talk about how one of the things that makes a good founder is they operate very well in uncertain environments. Would you say that's true? And how do you cope? What mechanisms do you use to cope in uncertain environments?
It's a great question. I think I try to kind of bring as much certainty in with data as much as possible for making decisions and for kind of moving in the direction that we think is best. I mean, we do a lot of A/B testing, a lot of multivariate testing, but there are certainly sometimes you just have to go with your gut and kind of trust that. And it's something that honestly, over time, I think I've just gotten more comfortable with. I think it just takes those reps of going through that cycle and learning, you know, okay, this is really uncertain, but going to go with our best guess and move forward and then kind of see what happens.
That tells me that you might have a certain amount of traffic then if you can do these A/B tests. Like, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I have enough traffic to do that. I go to these data science conferences, and there's engineers at Google, and they're talking about these things called multi-arm bandits, which is like a clinical trial on steroids, you know, that has like many different arms. And then as the experiment goes on, you cull the arms that obviously aren't going to work. And I'm thinking, you've got quite a lot of traffic, haven't you, like, to make that work? But it's just an interesting idea. I wondered what would happen if we did real clinical trials using multi-arm bandits, like how many drugs would be left at the end of a multi-arm bandit? Like, probably none.
That'd be very interesting in the health space.
So talk about, there's some things that you do to cope with the stress. You know, we've talked about this offline, and I'm not sure if Simon has ever talked about this on the podcast, actually, but Simon, one of the first things, we have. We talked about the stress audit, right? So this is the idea that the true stress ninja has things that are both kind of coping mechanisms, right? Like they tackle the stress at me, the target, and then also what you might call avoidant, right? Like I'm just going to like cut this thing out of my life, and that will of course reduce the stress levels. And the true stress ninja has coping strategies or tools on both sides of the equation, right? Like I'm not just cutting things out, I'm not just coping, I do both. And I'm wondering, is that like the stress audit? Have you ever done, like, can you think of things that you do to cope with the stress of being a founder that fall into both of those two categories?
You know, I think Simon was very helpful to me in that regard of, you know, one of the things was setting up the, you know, green light, yellow light, red light system and deciding, okay, if it's really stressful, if this is a, you know, yellow light or red light, I'm not going to do this. And I guess that would be the avoidant.
That's the strategy, isn't it?
Yeah. That's been incredible for me personally. I think, you know, the other side of it of kind of getting ahead of the curve, you know, big one is just sleep and consistency there is what I've found.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck trying to get anything done when you're used to shortchange yourself on sleep. Yeah, I sometimes forget like how epically terrible it feels when you don't get enough sleep. We had a couple of days when we were traveling. My goodness, the next day you feel like you got a hangover even though you didn't drink anything. It's awful. Yeah, don't do that, kids. Get enough sleep. It's a good idea. I guess just for a little bit more background for people listening, Simon's traffic light system is an extension of his Seeds method that I have yet to implement in the journal software implementation of his method that I created recently. The goal is to build these health promoting behaviors, tiny health promoting behaviors that stack up and flourish like a garden over time. So Seeds is both an acronym and a metaphor. Seeds stands for sleep, exercise, eating, drinking, and stress management. And so the idea is you plant these tiny seeds under each pillar of health, and then gradually over time they flourish into a garden. But of course, life gets in the way, right? And you need to give yourself permission to suck at adulting sometimes. Those are Simon's words, which I very much enjoy. So yeah, as a founder, like shit like that's going to happen all the time. Oh my God, I've got to go to a business trip to New York or whatever. Like there's no way I'm going to be able to get all these things done. Rather than saying, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do nothing. I'm like, okay, so what are my red light seeds? What are the core things that must happen in order for me to keep my shit together today? And it not prevents, but it helps people get away from all or nothing thinking and catastrophizing and awfulizing all these lovely words that psychologists use. Super helpful. You can find that software at seedsjournal.net if you're interested. Well, that's great. Great to hear. I'm really excited about that. Yeah. Let's talk about type one then, because you know way more about type one than I do. So I'm very curious to learn what you've learned about type one diabetes. Tell us the story of the diagnosis.
Yeah, so it's kind of a funny story. One of our cats growing up had been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes about 6 months before.
Where's this going?
Yeah. And seems like there might have been something environmental, but a few months later, I started getting really ill, really sick. I was drinking gallons and gallons of water, gallons of milk, always thirsty.
Yeah.
And, you know, the doctors gave me MRI scans, CT scans. They thought I had nasal infections, lots of antibiotics, nothing helped. And started to lose my vision. Everything was just really blurry because of all the water I was retaining. And, you know, ultimately, as a joke at that time, my mom came to me and said, hey, here's a urine test strip from the cat. Why don't you go pee on this and see what happens? And so I did.
It was literally for the cat. It wasn't even...
Well, it's the same thing. It's just measuring glucose in a liquid. You know, lo and behold, I did. It's super high. And that was how we found out. So I went to the hospital and learned about, you know, the early type 1 diabetes treatment at that point.
And so how old were you at this point?
I was 17 at that point.
Okay. And how many doctors did you see before you figured that out?
We had just been going to kind of my primary care physician at the time. But actually, I forgot in there, also had my tonsils removed because those were really inflamed during all of this. So probably 3 or 4 total.
So you went in and you had a surgery and never once did they check your glucose?
No.
That's amazing, isn't it? So where would you have been if you're like your dear mum had not told you to pee on a glucose strip?
I know. No, I.
How long would it have gone on?
Think about that. It's crazy. That's funny.
Completely bonkers.
Yeah.
You went back and what did the primary care physician refer you to an endocrinologist or did you just get the diagnosis right there and then in the PCP's office?
So the PCP had me pee on one of their test strips.
Oh, because yours might not be quite.
Right. Yeah. They're like, oh,
to confirm that you're not a liar. You're not a raving loon.
And they confirmed it. And then they sent me to the ER because my blood sugar at that time was, I think, 1,100. And
holy shit, that's a record. I've heard of some in the hundreds, but yeah, that's, wow.
That was up there. So sent me straight to the ER. I was in the, the hospital for 3 days. I mean, now I think protocol's a day, but they kind of got my blood sugar under control and then trained me for a couple days on treatment.
Right. How long did it take before you started feeling better?
Once I was taking insulin, it happened pretty quickly. I mean, I was feeling better, within kind of a couple days, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Insulin's powerful.
Yeah. It does some useful stuff.
It does.
People talk about the war on insulin, but yeah, I think it does some useful stuff. That's fascinating. So did they ever try and, as an engineer, I almost want to understand the process that led to the problem before I try and remediate it. That seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do anywhere in your life, right? If you ripped up some carpet tiles and you found a bunch of mold underneath, I probably want to know where the moisture is coming from before I slap down some new carpet tiles, right? And so I think maybe the same should be true in medicine, but rarely happens. People like doctors tend to shrug and they say, oh, these things happen and we did everything we could. But what happens for you? Did they make any attempt to understand the process that led to?
No, not really. I mean, the prevailing theory at the time was that there was a virus kind of that triggered it. Usually diagnoses happen relatively early in life. Mm-hmm. I mean, today autoimmune is becoming more and more common later in life, especially type 1 diabetes. But, it's largely been juvenile diabetes as the name.
Yeah, they don't call it that anymore, do they?
No.
Huh.
No. And so they didn't really do anything else but say that of, likely you caught a virus that triggered it in you.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did this happen in a vacuum? Were there any other, it's hard to say that they were unrelated because they almost certainly weren't, but did you have any other issues? Did you notice any food sensitivities, any other GI problems or anything else? It was just that and nothing else.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, for me at the time when I was in high school, that was during the winter when I was less active. So, I was a two-sport athlete and I had the winter off, soccer in the fall and then lacrosse in the spring. And so, I think there was that. If I was much less active all of a sudden and, I also wasn't sleeping that well at the time, I remember. So, I think there were some other things possibly going on, but that could have kind of accelerated that maybe, but hard to say.
Do you still play those sports now? Again, tell us about lacrosse now. I'm British and lacrosse is a game they play in posh schools for girls. I don't think I've ever seen it played.
It's a fun sport. I do not play anymore. It's quite a fun sport. Uh-huh. Relatively popular here in the States now.
Yeah. What about rugby as well?
So I wasn't good enough to play Division I lacrosse, which led me to rugby in college. And fell in love with rugby. It is just such a fun, great sport. Had a lot of fun playing that, but don't do that anymore after a few concussions.
Oh, really?
So yeah, that led me to endurance and ultimately led me to NBT as a result of that.
Awesome. So you don't seem to have the cauliflower ears thing. Have you ever noticed that?
I avoided that. I taped up my ears.
Oh, is that all you have to do to stop that from
happening? Yeah, it's impact and kind of pulling and all that happens when you're rucking. So yeah, if you tape up your ears, you can avoid that.
Huh. Yeah. My goodness, I never knew that. I just thought that was like part and parcel of the sport. That's amazing. So talk about those early days then after you initially got the diagnosis of type 1. What do they like? What, they send you home with some way to measure your glucose and then glucose tabs, some insulin to inject of some sort, and what, and any dietary recommendations or?
So dietary recommendations were eat like you were always eating.
Okay.
Just don't change anything. Which I was eating relatively high carb at the time. The protocol was measuring all carbohydrates. So, I mean, my mom was great in this. She, made sure that we were weighing all the food I was eating and calculating the exact amount of carbohydrates and then injecting exactly for that. And, over time, I kind of got a very good sense of actually what number of carbs was in what food. But, early on, that was literally looking it up in a book. I mean, this was before smartphones. This was before MyFitnessPal or anything out there on the internet that shows number of carbs. So you had that side of it. And then the other side was blood glucose meters where you're pricking your finger all the time. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to know what my blood sugar was. So I was checking, 12 times a day and just always checking before a meal, after every meal, in between, before sports, during sports, after sports. And, that's why today CGMs are amazing, to be able to have you know, hundreds of measurements every day as opposed to just 12 and see more directionality. And we can talk more about that.
Yeah.
But I know you already know all the benefits of CGM, but back then, you know, CGMs
didn't
exist.
Not for type one. I mean, it's a different, I mean, I thought about that the other day. Actually, I was walking the dogs around the block here and somebody's garbage just like being knocked over by a raccoon or something. And there are all these used finger stick tests, you know, like, I mean, I've done them, like hundreds of them as well, but it's just different when you see like hundreds that have all just fallen out of someone's trash and you're thinking, blimey, somebody's invested a significant amount of life force into checking their glucose.
Yeah.
And what a difference a CGM would make to that person, you know?
No kidding. Well, and just so much better data to actually see trends because, you know, with finger sticks, you're just looking at one point in time and so hard to know, you know, am I going up? Am I going down? What do I do as a result?
And then did you track anything else that might give you an idea about how you're doing over the longer term? So hemoglobin A1C, for example.
We were tracking hemoglobin A1C, and I still do every 6 months. I don't think mine is particularly accurate, you know, especially now that I have a CGM. I think mine, you know, my A1C measures kind of lower than it should.
What is it?
My last was, I think, 5.2. Which, based on my CGM, I think I should be a little bit higher than that. But
yeah,
I don't know what would cause that.
Well, it depends how long the red blood cells stick around for, right? Mm. So the HbA1c test is normalized for red blood cells living for 90 days. Hmm. And if they live any longer or shorter, then that would affect the hemoglobin A1c. And there's an equation that I can cite in the show notes. And you can measure reticulocytes. Have you ever, you're on our program, we measure reticulocytes for you?
I'm not sure.
We should
look
into that. We should definitely look into that. I mean, I suppose it's an intellectual curiosity to some degree, but you can measure reticulocytes, which are baby red blood cells. It's a $5 blood test. And then you can plug the reticulocytes into this formula and it will tell you how long your red blood cells live. And then from there, I'm not sure there's an exact equation to correct the hemoglobin A1C, but it will at least give you some sense of whether they're living longer. It will tell you the lifespan in days, and then that would tell you. Well, so, I mean, that's incredible, though, for a type 1 to achieve a hemoglobin A1C that low. Was that true from the beginning? Did you always?
It always was. I mean, you know, early on, you still have some of your islet cells producing insulin.
Okay.
So there's this period they call the honeymoon period where it's just easier because you still have more support from your body. So I think I certainly don't think I should anymore, but I think I may still because, you know, it seems like balancing glucose for me is a little bit easier than it may be for others. So I don't know if that's because my body's still producing insulin or not, but it's always kind of been in that range.
Right.
I mean, I'm also very particular about even today, you know, knowing exactly what I eat, how many carbs are in it, and calculating everything. So that's been something that I think was a result of me being diagnosed, you know, when I was in high school and wanting to go become an engineer where I could actually view it as a systems problem and tackle it as, okay, if I have all these inputs, I can calculate exactly what I need to do to optimize it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good place to ask you. So tell us about your education. What is your background?
So I ended up studying electrical engineering and computer science. And so, you know, I actually have written some programs to kind of analyze all my old data and looked at all of that over time to kind of pull out trends and different things to optimize for. That's just always been kind of a curiosity for me.
And that's great. That's awesome. So what was it like then? You think there's a difference with you being diagnosed later in life versus as a kid?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, that's been one of my observations in, you know, now interacting within the type 1 diabetes community and knowing lots of other folks who have type 1 diabetes where, you know, if you're diagnosed early, it's more of just this is the way life is. And you know, for me and some others that I know who are diagnosed later, it's like, okay, how do we go crack this? How do we solve this and make it such that we can live the way we were as much as possible before and not let this impact our lives. You know, N equals one. I'm speaking a lot from my own experience, but I think age of diagnosis definitely had a fair amount to do with that.
It does seem, I mean, if the goal is near normal blood sugar, then it does seem like a solvable problem now. We've had, believe it or not, we've had a couple of type 1s on the podcast already. Keith Runyon was one, and he was doing a really great job of managing. In fact, I think he's still blogging about this now, about managing his blood sugar with a combination of a low carbohydrate ketogenic diet and Olympic lifting. I remember that was like a big thing for him. You've probably noticed that too, haven't you? Like the, what is it, 75% of glucose is disposed in skeletal muscle independent of insulin. You know, that's going to be a big lever for you to pull right there.
It is, yeah. I've always noticed when I'm doing weight training, it's much easier to, you know, reduce glucose variability.
Oh, interesting.
And maintain blood sugars in a range, just because I am much more insulin sensitive.
Yeah, you've just made a big hole and like right. Something wants to fill it, right? That's the way to think of it. Yeah, so tell me about your approach to carbohydrate consumption. I mean, you just quoted a spectacular hemoglobin A1C that anybody should be proud of, assuming that there's not some weird pathology that we don't understand, that your red blood cells don't stick around for long enough to get glycated. But I mean, I don't think so. I think this is just a number that you should be proud of. Like, so how does carbohydrate intake? Like, can you just eat as many carbs as you want and still get that number? Or is it?
Theoretically, I think you could, as long as you're injecting the right amount of insulin. You know, I view having diabetes is kind of a roller coaster ride where you're the driver, and the ups that you get with glucose are, you know, controlled with insulin. And, you know, typically in, you know, your body, someone without type 1 diabetes, you're automatically regulating both ends of those. The biggest challenge for me, and I think, you know, type 1 diabetics in general, is just staying within that core range, which naturally, if you're not raising yourself up as much and having to inject as much insulin, there's much lower variability. So for me, low carbohydrate has been a huge, huge component of that, to be able to, you know, not have to inject as much insulin. And therefore, even if I'm wrong on a certain dose or I miscalculated something, the error is going to be smaller. And so you're just keeping it within tighter bounds. And so as a result of that, I've eaten low carb for years. You know, more recently, you know, thanks to NBT, you know, experimenting with AIP, which has been great, and, you know, identified some other, you know, kind of food sensitivities. But yeah, low carbohydrate, I think, really, really helps.
You know, the reason why I think you type 1s are so interesting to everyone is you're forced to do the self-monitoring bit, right? Like most people like me can just eat the stuff they want. And for the most part, I literally can eat anything now. In terms of like the glycemic variability just doesn't seem to have any impact on me at all in the way that I feel. And that wasn't always the case. At one point, I couldn't even make it through the night without eating breakfast. I used to get up at 2 a.m. to eat cereal because I couldn't make it through the night. But now it doesn't seem to make any difference, but I'm pretty sure it does. Like inside, I think it does. We know that certainly fasting glucose is a predictor of mortality, and glycemic variability is generally not a good thing. And I've seen some nice micrograph images of high glucose stripping away the glycocalyx, which is this glycoprotein layer that lines the endothelial cell. So, you know, if I choose to have that gluten-free cupcake, do I nuke my glycocalyx? Quite possibly. If I were to do that 3 times a day, well, I've then just removed the first line of defense that's protecting those endothelial cells. If too many endothelial cells get stripped away, well, that's atherosclerosis, right? Like, you really don't want that. It's the number one killer in the US. Now, the reason why I think type 1s are so interesting is because you are forced to do the self-monitoring bit, right? Several times on the podcast before, I've talked about Simon, who always says that self-monitoring is the cornerstone of behavior change. It just doesn't happen unless you're paying attention. And this is true in other areas of our life. As a founder, you know, I'm sure you've got a dashboard with some core metrics that you know are valuable. And recently I was visiting my mum in Scotland, and she's got this fancy meter on the side of a wall that tells her how much electricity she's using at any one time. I don't have that where I live in California. Like right here in Silicon Valley, I don't have that. So how am I supposed to improve my electricity consumption, assuming that less is better? Maybe PG&E would disagree with that. They generally seem to want me to use less, which seems paradoxical, but I guess they have their reasons. But how am I supposed to do that if I don't know how much electricity I'm using? Like, how do I know I'm winning? Like, you just can't. So I think that the type 1s are so interesting because you're forced to play that game. And you've rejected the insulin pump for this reason, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I wore a pump for 2 years, which was good. I mean, it was good to kind of try it. What I found was my A1C actually increased during that time. And, you know, largely, I think that was the impact of it was just easier to inject. And therefore, I would find myself eating that cupcake or something else because, oh, I can just click a few buttons and you know, no problem. I will have injected for it versus, you know, the small amount of friction of having to, you know, take out the insulin pen and dial it and inject that amount made me think about it just enough where I wouldn't actually eat that cupcake. I'd say, oh no, you know, I don't need that. It's just going to make this more difficult after all. And so, you know, that led to worse control during that time. And, you know, ultimately I also didn't love having something attached to me, but it was that control that really got me.
That's interesting. So you somehow made this connection that more insulin was worse. Like we just kind of implied that really, but somehow you figured that out, right? That maybe you didn't want to use so much of this. I mean, it's a medicine. Maybe that's the thing that makes you decide that maybe less is better. How did you make that decision that less was better?
It was exactly what you were just talking about with the feedback loop of I actually saw the, you know, increase in A1C and said, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? And I think I saw that okay. The first time and said, oh, maybe this is just an outlier. But, you know, I think my A1C went up to low sixes.
Oh, wow. That's a huge increase.
Which is a big jump. And I was like, hey, wait a minute, you know, must just be an outlier. And then that happened a couple times. And, you know, at that point, I kind of made the connection and realized I was just doing a lot worse with it.
Uh-huh. Does the technology exist now? I really don't know that much about it. You would think that if they can, like, they can't just measure and administrate the insulin from the same device so that you don't even need to get involved.
So they do have closed loop systems now, which are, you know, I think the first one came on the market last year, and I think there are two more this year and, you know, a few more in the pipeline from all the various pump companies. The challenge is the lag, because when you're measuring in the subcutaneous fluid, you have a 15-minute delay from your actual blood glucose.
Right.
And then further, because of the time it takes for insulin, even the latest synthetic insulins, to act in your system, you have at least an hour before the insulin's really hitting its peak and impacting your blood sugar. So you have an hour and 15 minutes in the best case scenario. And so those systems are pretty good. The best impact of those systems is overnight because you don't have any outside variables. You're not eating anything and there's no exercise. You're just laying there. And I was actually in a study at Stanford for one of the early devices a few years ago. And I did love that about it, but it's not as if you can just not tell it when you eat or anything during the day and have it solve for that because of those delays.
You can't just take a picture of what you're about to eat with your cell phone.
They haven't done that yet.
They can't measure. There's these increasing hormones that change almost immediately when you start eating, like GLP-1 and others. I wonder if they can measure those in the subcutaneous fluid. Like, that'd be cool.
That would be.
Yeah. So tell me about, what's the meter, the CGM that you use now?
So I use the Dexcom G6.
Okay. And how is it? I actually wore the G5 for a while.
Nice. It's same thing, just slightly smaller profile. And you don't have to calibrate it anymore, which is nice. So you put it on 2 hours later, you have a reading, and you know it lasts for 10 days. And it's incredible. I mean, the accuracy is really good. I still, you know, just because I think I've built up that habit over time, I still do finger sticks occasionally just to kind of check in on it.
How does it match up?
Usually spot on.
Okay.
If you're changing really rapidly, I've seen, you know, some discrepancies, but in general, it's impressively accurate.
That's really great. Talk about some of the other variables, right? So we talked a little bit about sleep and we talked about carbohydrate consumption. Is there anything else that you found that has a big impact on what you see on the CGM?
So the other big ones for me with regard to insulin sensitivity are, you know, certainly sleep, but also stress is big.
Okay.
You know, especially any like infection or you get the flu or a cold, you know, much more insulin resistant during those times.
Okay.
You know, the inverse of that is actually the recency of exercise. So kind of consistent exercise within kind of a 36-hour window, I've found to be really important for me, because once I cross somewhat even a 24-hour window, but especially 36 hours from my last time exercising, I need a lot more insulin for things. Okay. And so there seems to be that kind of critical period where I am much more insulin sensitive. And, you know, also hydration is the other that, you know, surprisingly, if I get dehydrated and then drink a ton of water, my blood sugar will just drop. very quickly. And so that's another thing I focus on.
Is that just an artifact, or is it because you're not actually measuring blood, are you? Measuring the interstitial fluid? Is that just a... I have to look into that. That's a kind of
I'm not sure
thing.
I think it is a real change, but I'm not sure what the mechanism is.
Okay. So when you first signed up for the program, I think you identified more strongly as an endurance athlete, didn't you?
I did.
I think we're setting up this kind of business where we, Zach, I'm gonna pin this on Zach. Zach Moore, he sits in a confession booth with a little curtain. And the triathletes, they walk in with their jersey with the cut-off sleeves and one of those aero helmets, you know, and they walk into the confession booth. And then Zach gives them permission to get rid of the aero helmet and pick up the barbell. And then 6 months later, they're on the podcast giving us a testimonial about how great it feels to live in this body with all this muscle mass.
That is true. I blame it on Zach as well. I give Zach all the credit. He's been... great and put together an awesome program for me that, I was, I think, overtraining significantly for triathlons and trying to squeeze that into everything right. else that was going
what
on.
It's kind of interesting to me. You're a founder. You obviously don't have a lot of spare time to play around with stuff. Like, what is the appeal of triathlon at that point? When you've got, I have trouble being good, even a little bit good at just one sport. I just can't imagine trying to be good at three sports at once.
I think it actually goes back to what you said at the start about uncertainty, because you have so much certainty in triathlons of, hey, if I put in this effort and I do this, I can increase my results by this. It's very clearly measured of, your times.
Yeah, I see that.
And, you contrast that with
it's the antidote
startup life. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that was a large part of what drew me to it.
That's interesting. Yeah, mountain biking is highly stochastic and you can't predict anything, It's like what might be the winning formula for one race could be useless in another because there's a bunch of wet routes and something, you know what I mean? It's like it's very hard to predict. Unlike triathlon, whereas if you can hold however many watts per kilo for whatever duration, you pretty much know what time that's going to get you and what time you need to in order to do well at that stage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very deterministic. So talk about the transition into... so obviously you have a history as what I would call a strength athlete, right? Rugby is
right.
Surely a strength athlete. And so it just wasn't a hard decision for you to make then. Yeah, you're right. I can see that this triathlon thing isn't really working for me at this time. And perhaps a more strength-based approach would be more consistent with a goal. Did you think rationally like that or what else went on?
Well, I think a big part of it was I was just totally depleted and seriously overtrained where I had no energy. Walking up, our office is up a couple flight of stairs. Walking up those stairs was really hard.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is crazy. I'm still a young guy. This should not be this hard.
Yeah.
So that was a big part of it. And, the other was really focusing on health span and, all the research out there about, the importance of strength for longevity and health span, which, having been a rugby player and, having much more strength and, muscle mass and then going to endurance and losing a lot of that.
Did you actually lose? You look great now. You look like you're carrying a ton of muscle mass, but
I lost a bunch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. I was still not the typical triathlete build because of that, but I had lost probably 25 pounds of muscle mass.
Oh my God. So you're making, I've been listening to Ben House's podcast, which has been very good. He's had some excellent guests, including Tommy, actually, recently. I forget what the exact numbers were, but, he's got to the point where he's just so close to his genetic potential. Even just any amount of muscle gain is good news for him. And so, yeah, I'm sure if he were to hear that, 25 pounds of muscle would make him cry. That's like a lifetime of achievement. But so how much have you put back on?
I think I've put back on about 10 at this point. Working with Zach. So
okay.
Pretty quick gains, but I think I was helped by that program a lot.
Okay. And what sort of movements?
A lot of kind of the core of, deadlift, bench, and squats.
Mm-hmm. And were those movements that you already knew how to do? Were you competent with those before?
Squats and bench, yes. I wasn't with deadlifts. So I'm still working up in kind of into more advanced deadlifts and doing the full one.
Okay.
But everything else I was relatively familiar with already.
Okay. And how have you been learning to deadlift? It's kind of a, I've been lifting weights since I was 17, but I was exactly the same. The deadlift is kind of scary,
right?
Because you think you're gonna, your back's gonna explode or something. And yeah, it's even more scary when like a bunch of people are watching you do it in the gym. So how did you learn to do it? You've never met Zach in person, right? Like, did you do it remotely?
All remotely. So some great, you know, initial videos that Zach shared that have really helped kind of get me to this point. And, you know, I'm excited to kind of keep going and keep optimizing that.
There's so many videos online now. It's really hard to find the good one. Like, I don't even know whether this is like a good video or not. And so having Zach say, oh yeah, this is the video I like to teach you how to deadlift is just insanely valuable.
It really is.
Really good. Yeah. And then so did you exchange a bunch of cell phone videos where he like looks at you from the side? And
I actually haven't done that yet.
Oh my goodness.
That's the next phase.
This is not the lean startup approach to deadlifting, is it? It's like the builds, measure, learn. Like you can't, if you don't measure, how are you going to? Yeah, Zach is really good at that. It might just be like, I don't know. I feel like people feel something. It doesn't feel right. Like you can, if it's not working.
Yeah. I work out in a very small gym, so I haven't set that up yet, but I need to.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm making a false assumption. I should get Zach on to talk about this, but certainly when he fixed something for me, like it was noticeable in the way that I felt. Like it was quite, I had a lot of weird muscle soreness the next day until I talked to Zach about exactly where the bar should be with respect to my legs. It sounds like a crude thing, but it really did help. So talk about some of the work you've done with Clay. This is like genuine inquisition, by the way. I've seen some of Tim's results for sure, because I look at all the results, but sometimes it's quite hard for me to connect the person with the lab results, you know? And we've reached a point where I do work with clients on a regular basis, especially with the blood chemistry side of things since I wrote the software. But it's really somebody else that's doing most of the heavy lifting at MBT. And the main thing I do is the podcast, which is great. I'm quite happy with that. So talk about what it was like to work with Clay.
It's been great to work with Clay. You know, I came in also with some gut issues that he, you know, helped resolve and kind of bring to light, and then a couple protocols to, you know, work on those over time. And
do you mind talking about the symptoms?
Yeah, just, you know, this was another reason I left triathlon. I was going to try and avoid this, Chris.
Yeah,
I guess we'll go there.
This is like, if you don't want to talk about poop, then you're listening to the wrong podcast
there, right,
at this point.
Good. I mean, I would make it a couple miles into a run and just have to go find a bathroom immediately. And it was literally, and it was just, you know, really bad. And, you know, all of that is gone now, thankfully.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like a game changer right there. You know, you're looking for a 5% performance improvement.
Right.
If I can keep you at the porta potties, then there's it right there. You don't need to do any additional training.
Yeah.
And did you notice, like, was there any food triggers with that? I mean, it's obviously like a stress. It's like your type one, right? It's obviously not just the thing that I put in my mouth that's leading to the number I see on the CGM. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think it's true with exercise-induced diarrhea as well. It's obviously not just what you had for breakfast. It's a bit more complicated than that.
Right. I think one of the things that Clay immediately suggested I go off of is bulletproof coffee.
Oh, shit, yeah.
I think that had a big impact on it. The other that I actually found in, you know, later in the program doing AIP, you know, at Clay's recommendation, was a sensitivity to dairy. And so I was still putting cream in my coffee and all of that at that point. And that, I think, was the final piece that really, really put the nail in it.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I don't think we've got anything against bulletproof coffee in general, though you might argue it's kind of a nutrient poor source of calories, isn't it? Like as a dude in my mid 40s, I kind of want all of my food to have nutrients in it. And you can't really say that about bulletproof coffee.
No.
And it's also an excellent way to deliver endotoxins, right? So liquids, fats are really good at translocating endotoxins from the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. And so that combination might not be a good one for some people. It does make you feel fucking awesome, though. Have you tried it? Like, have you been off? I went to a conference once and they were serving bulletproof coffee, and I've been off coffee for a long time. So I was completely naive to caffeine. Well, not completely, because I still drank a bit of tea, but it just doesn't do the same thing to me. So I've not had coffee for a long time, and they have bulletproof coffee. So the combination of, you know, like the grass-fed butter with the C8 MCT oil and really good coffee, I felt like I'd been like taking some sort of crazy drug or something. It was amazing. It makes you feel great. It's easy to see why people continue with that.
Oh, it's great. It is amazing.
And do you still use it? Is it like your nootropic of choice as a founder?
I do drink probably too much coffee, more than I should, but I don't do Bulletproof anymore.
Okay.
Although I have at a conference here and there.
Okay.
It is
so
that
you
good.
Obviously, I mean, you did AIP and you got results with that, but as everyone listening knows, that it's not forever. Mm-hmm. And the point of the diet is the reintroductions, right? So you eliminate some foods and you give your gut a chance to heal, and then you do the reintroductions and hopefully they go well, but there's a really good chance you discover something that you're not able to reintroduce, and that's okay. So for that, for you, it was dairy, but you have obviously been able to successfully reintroduce coffee.
I have, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I've been kind of working through those and AIP was an eye-opener of like, oh, okay, this actually does, you know, impact me. So,
yeah, that's awesome. And then so Clay found some, like I remember seeing your GI map results were kind of funky. So you did a stool test and there was some stuff going on there. I remember seeing elevated secretory IgA, I believe. So your immune system was responding. So that tells me that maybe your immune system is responding to something in the gut.
Right.
The question then becomes, well, what? Is it a food sensitivity? Is it something else? And you can look at something else on the stool test, but you don't really ever know for sure. But you found, like, you did some botanical herbs and that was helpful.
That was very helpful.
Excellent. So now, or is it just that you stopped doing triathlon and that's what fixed your gut? It's possible, isn't it?
Hard to say now, but no, I think it was, I still enjoy long runs and long bike rides and all of that. Not quite the same frequency, but I attribute it to all the herbs and the protocol.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so you still ride on the road then?
I do. Yeah, although experimenting with mountain biking.
Okay, yeah, we're gonna have to convert you to mountain biking. Well, Santa Cruz is definitely the place to come to ride bike. I mean, I think for you, it probably would be the easiest and best place, no matter what.
Right.
And I think it's one of the best places on the West Coast to ride bike. So you have to come down, and we'll have to do some more. I do take that for granted now, actually. That like how it's just like problems that you just don't notice them until they're gone. You know, I can remember like having so many rides ruined by bloating was like my thing. I never really, it did happen occasionally that I'd have to like run into the bushes and like evacuate. But for the most part, it was just terrible bloating that, you know, it feels like you need to like fart for 45 seconds and the pain will go away. And sometimes that did happen, but mostly it didn't. So you'd just be riding around with this bowling ball. You're like really ruin a ride, you know, like really sucks. And I forget all the time, like, you know, I rode my bike today and I never thought about that. And sometimes I feel guilty for not thinking about that, you know, like it's like such an tremendous relief to have that go away and how quickly we forget. But yeah, when I looked at your blood chemistry calculator report this morning, I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing that this guy has a metabolic health score that is at the top end of the interquartile range for all blood chemistry calculator users. So you know who's using this. It's just like the people who are the most motivated to improve their health. So it's a type 1 to have a metabolic health score of 89. I think that's quite extraordinary. Like, what the hell? I mean, that's what I think when I look at this. Is like, this guy has got normal fasting glucose, as in normal within the optimal reference range. That no, like it's 82 to 88 milligrams per deciliter. Most non-diabetics can't hit that, and you have done it. The low glycomark might be right. Glycomark predicts glycemic variability, and then elevated free fatty acids. I sort of believe that prediction too. But that is quite incredible. Do you talk to many other type ones, and like, is there any difference between what you're doing and what they're doing?
I talk to a bunch. There's kind of a group that we've put together that, you know, we chat about the latest technologies and kind of what to use and what kind of tips and tricks we're using these days. You know, I think the biggest thing for me is low carb. Not everyone wants to do that. And, you know, it is doable with more insulin to eat more carbohydrates, but it just creates so much more variability. And I think that's still relatively, not fringe, but, you know, obviously it's becoming more popular, but lesser known. Aside from that though, no, pretty much all the same.
That's extraordinary. I mean, I know you couldn't technically, but if you could give advice to parents, let's say I have my kid turns out to be type 1, right? Bauer's 18 months old. It's still possible. Like, what advice? Imagine I was completely naive, still doing what I was doing 10 years ago. Cereal for breakfast, sandwich for lunch, pasta for dinner. As far as I'm concerned, this problem has nothing to do with diet. I'm just going to go ahead and keep eating that diet and then use the insulin to cover it. Would you ever give advice to parents? Like, could you do that, you think?
I don't know if I'm qualified to.
Yeah,
but I
would say technical.
Right, yes.
Yeah. Licensing stuff aside, this is a hypothetical thought.
Hypothetically,
experiment.
Would be shift to low carb. I mean, eggs in the morning, or you know, other low carb options, and throughout the day.
Yeah. Has it ever come up, by the way? Like, do you ever met like parents? They've just got a newly diagnosed type 1, and they've
quite a lot actually. It's terrifying. You find like you have no knowledge of this. Your child is diagnosed. You're reaching out for help and want
so people have. So it's not a thought experiment then.
Right.
Like it really has happened.
It has happened.
You
know, and you know, low carb is a big shift, especially if your family doesn't do that. But you know, the other thing I usually suggest as well is get a CGM as soon as possible. You know, unfortunately, due to insurance, not everyone can because of the coverage, but it helps so much. Mm. It's just a game changer to be able to see all the trends and have those tight feedback loops.
So do you know anyone that's done this with someone younger and gotten good results?
There are some families I know that actually have children on ketogenic diets and they have better glucose control than I do. It's absurd. I mean, literally.
I mean, that really is like extraordinary because you have excellent glucose control. But yeah, I mean, better than a normal person.
I mean, then. Exactly. It's amazing.
And what are the resources? Like if you could link any. So I know about the type 1 group on Facebook is excellent and I should link to them. And is there any other resources that online that you found useful?
There's a great nonprofit out of San Francisco called Diatribe that puts out a newsletter, and you know, one of their editors, Adam Brown, has written this book, Bright Spots and Landmines, which talks a lot about, you know, best practices and, you know, pitfalls to avoid within type 1 diabetes. I mean, a lot of it applies to the general public as well, but, you know, it's specifically geared towards type 1 that is incredibly helpful. So I'd recommend that as well.
So do you have an online presence where people can find you? You on LinkedIn? Can people find you on Owler or anywhere else?
I am on LinkedIn. I'm also on Owler. You know, best place to connect is probably LinkedIn or, you know, via email. And I can give you that to put in the show notes.
Yeah. And thank you so much, Clay.
yeah. Thank you, Clay.
We very much appreciate you doing all the hard work. And then I don't mind at all just rocking up and doing the podcast. Well, would you recommend the program?
I would. I was telling Clay this the other day, and I told you this earlier. You know, it's been a game changer for me. I mean, this last year has been an absolute whirlwind. And, you know, throughout all of that, I've continually felt better and better. And I'm now feeling better than I have in, you know, years, really, in recent memory. And I attribute that to the program.
That's amazing.
And, you know, working with NBT. So, very much so.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you to Clay and Zach and Simon and Tammy and Elaine and everyone else involved. There's all these people behind the scenes that do all the hard work. I appreciate all those people. Well, Tim, thank you so much. I very much appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.